Navajo poet Sherwin Bitsui, author of the 2018 collection Dissolve, is known for exploring American life with a painterly eye. Born in Fort Defiance, Arizona in 1975, he combines elements from his indigenous culture with European modernism and surrealism, stating that the poem is the residue of what is being unsaid.
When you read my work, there's always something that is kept out. I feel like that's really what I'm creating. I'm creating this negative space within my work, and that's the poetry.
Stay with us for this classic conversation with Sherwin Bitsui, who reads from his early books, Shapeshift and the 2010 American Book Award winner, Flood Song, today on New Letters on the Air. From UMKC's New Letters magazine, I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with the poet when he visited Kansas City as part of Park University's 2011 Ethnic Voices Poetry Series. Here's the White Award winner and Lannan Literary Fellow, Sherwin Bitsui, with a poem from his first book, Shapeshift.
Bodies wanting wood. When the fire turns, I lotion my arms. The woman weaves a storm design, smells rain in the canyon floor. The wind in winter sleeps between our fingers. During prayer, it is released and blows into town, a swarm of locusts with wings on fire.
That's the poem, Bodies Wanting Wood. It's one of the older poems included in the collection Shapeshift by Sherwin Bitsui. And I thought it was interesting because it has sort of that shape-shifting quality to it.
Yeah, the prayer is released and blows and becomes a swarm of locusts. I think it's an expressive piece. It feels more expressionistic. The images are very precise. But interesting that I'm reading this almost 8 years later, and it feels different to me now.
Yeah. Can you talk about the meaning of shapeshift in your culture?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has a negative connotation, but I thought shapeshift was more of a metaphor for our times, especially as a Native person. I like the energy of the word, the kind of feeling that it gives people. Has a heavy connotation to it, and I thought I could play around with it, so I titled the book Shapeshift. But also, within the book, everything is in transformation. Everything is changing. You know, nothing is as it is. At the end of the book, a horse wants to peel itself into a flower. The hand becomes a wing in some other parts, you know. So it's not about shapeshifters, but I thought the title itself has a lot to do with what is within the book.
You know, I never really thought of shape-shifting as having a negative connotation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, culturally it does. It's the darker realm of humanity.
Okay. Yeah, because I had always imagined it being something shifts into another type of being, but I never really thought of it as being darker. That's interesting. Uh-huh. There's a dreamlike quality to a lot of this, too, mm-hmm. which I think adds into that whole shape shifting mm-hmm. idea. I wonder if I could get you to read The Noose in My Dream.
Yeah, this is probably one of these fever dreams within the book. The Noose in My Dream. I heard songs when the cactus wren sipped nectar from the tongue of a cricket. It was early. I remember the noose in my dream and a sailboat anchored to a dying whale. Imitating a sunset when there are no moist legs to comb silent, or beds burning in the sepia-colored lungs of the inferno. I heard songs and noticed in the uncovered wagon the mouth of the woman who licked the brow of the white fish, who dreamed of gills and was given a broken-lipped husband who cut silt from her tongue and abandoned the knife because it followed him like a stray dove. She gripped the steering wheel so tight that they buried her with it. I drive home, imagining a man suckling milk from the cliffs of Canyon de Chelly, and dream the awakening of knives inside grandmother's cabinet. In the rearview mirror, a storm hisses onto the horizon. A ceremony pales, then yellows. A plane arrives with mute passengers, calling a nation to drink water from the river underneath the race barrier.
That's the poem, The Noose in My Dream. It's from the first collection by Sherwin Bitsui called Shapeshift. This is New Letters on the Air. A lot of the images that come up in that show how you so deftly intertwine ancient ritual, But you also have a plane arriving with mute passengers. You know, you've got this modern world up against our natural world, and then all these strange images of life and death. And when you are composing a poem like this, do you see one image and then begin to build on it?
Some of these early poems, they began as dreams. I would wake up in the morning and begin to write down some lines. They occurred, but the lines have changed. I've edited them and I've changed a lot of the images. But I think a lot of the creative impulse began as a dream I had. I think with this poem, it just sort of evolved as images, and I kept seeing these images in my mind, and then I would put them on the page, and I think it was written over time with the several stanzas coming back into the poem. But certainly there is this notion of hearing songs from within a dream. Within a dream state, you're also listening to these songs. I heard songs and noticed in the uncovered wagon. And there's this image that keeps occurring in Shapeshift, which is the car accident, and it continues on within Flood Song. But in this case, there is this figure who gripped the steering wheel so tight that they buried her with it. I just remember a lot of my youth growing up in the desert, the long drives. We drove everywhere with family to the laundromat 45 miles away to do our laundry or to school. I went to school in a border town and rode the bus every day for 42 miles. So 80-mile round trip bus ride to school every
Wow.
for 6 years.
What did you do on the bus? Did you read? Did you
read? Yeah, listened to a lot of music, joked with friends. It just was what it was. I didn't know any other life. I mean, people still do it. My nephew's doing it now. So a lot of my memory of life really is about going between the reservation border into different states of time, in a way, different ways of seeing time. And when I go to school off the res, it would be this very linear life. And then you go back to the res and it has this circular quality. There's a real attention to the seasons and to nature and to an ancient time, a continuous historical lifeline that is always ever present. We live in this dichotomy, I guess. There's a sense of oneself living in two different worlds. I was fighting it for the longest time to say that I don't come from two worlds because that splits me in half. But I really think now I think about my life then and the memory, the cultural memories that I would have to drive between, in a way. The car is the vessel for story.
There really are two very different worlds when you think about the circular world of reservation life.
Yeah, even as far as language is concerned, you know, I think about Navajo language and how it performs. It's a very verb-driven language, so everything in Navajo is constantly in motion. And I think when you speak out into the world and describe the world as a moving world, and your language is moving among it also, that shapes or orients you to a type of perspective rather than English that seems to be very noun-driven. Rather than living in a world of objects or existing in a world where time is somehow measured in increments, somehow fastened to a grid. In Navajo, you sort of view time as a very, I don't know if it's circular, but it certainly feels like it spirals out constantly from certain areas. And it's really hard to explain, but it's there within the poetics. It's there within the way we resonate or reflect the world and ourselves as well, and the way we respond to it.
Mm. When you say that Dene is very verb-driven, can you give me an example of like a phrase and then how you would approach it in English?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing because one time I was actually speaking to some students in a part of the reservation where they mainly spoke Navajo. And I asked them, I said, could you describe to me that there's a man outside? And a lot of these students raised their hands and they were telling me all the different ways that they would say there's a man outside. So one kid would say, Hastin Tlotasiza. And then another kid would raise his hand and say, Hastin Tlotanava. another child would raise her hand and say, Hussein Tlota Eshwash. And I said, okay, well, then more kids raise their hands, and they told me different ways of saying there's a man outside. And I said, well, none of you guys told me there's a man outside. They're all like, what? Like, we just told you that, you know. And I said, really, what you told me is there is a man standing outside. There's a man walking outside. There's a man sleeping outside. The man is doing something, and that's what gives him presence, rather than just having him sort of exist outside. So that concept English has, that Navajo, I don't know if it doesn't have it, but Navajo makes it more specific. That person has to be alive, or that person has to be living to exist inside that sentence. So the verb part of it is that he is in motion, that he is doing something. So it is a language of life. It is a language that references things that are living. So you can't have this sort of abstract, objective other existing just for the sake of existing. The person has to be connected to a source, a life source as well. So it humanizes the figure. And they were all like, wow. I mean, we just take these things for granted, right? We come from different languages and we don't really realize how they might really shape our experience. And I think from my poetry, I'm able to speak in that middle place, to use both English and Navajo perspectives and thought within the poetic landscape that I'm creating.
When did it occur to you that there was this difference in the language?
I don't really know if there was one moment, because I would always notice when I talked to non-Navajos, there'd be a different way that they would communicate. They're attending to different things. Navajo thinkers or speakers would organize things in a different way than English thinkers would. I just sort of started seeing all this as I worked in my own poetics, as I started seeing my own work. I started uncovering a lot of these things and speaking to people who knew the language and my parents, and just listening, just seeing it. Even in translation, I was asked to translate one of my own poems recently.
Into Diné?
Because I write in English, I was asked to translate into Diné, yeah. And so one poem took like 2 weeks to translate. The poem is sort of the residue of what is being unsaid. So what is being unsaid is really what is really the language I am approaching, or I know that that language is between both places. I feel that's where poetry is, and that's our human connection. That's how we all connect to poetry. It's always what's outside of the poem. So the poem I translate is actually Nahastan, and it's a very small poem, and it's actually from Shapeshift.
Yeah, but why don't we have you read it?
Nahastan is Mother Earth. Mother thought, first we will run, then we will talk. She asked, do we ramble when we speak in tongues? Her lack of supervision made this happen. The dusk, the dawn, everything in between, a mistake. The morning, her toothache, the shovel dulled in daylight, all digging fire from shallowing rivers. Her plan, one big mistake. In this language, she was asked to sing, because in this room, there was never a light switch, never a search for the memory of onyx collecting against the rib. The origin, Ina.
Nahastan, from the book Shapeshift by Sherwin Bitsui. This is New Letters on the Air, and I'm Angela Elam, and we're talking about his draw towards language, both in the English that he works in and then his native tongue, Diné, except that you don't write in the Navajo language yet, do you?
Sometimes I try to compose Navajo poems orally as I'm driving, and I have yet to really invest serious time into it. It'll take a while. You know, I definitely will eventually write some full poems in Navajo. It's a language that already is very poetic, already has a lot of metaphor and beauty in it. And English because maybe it feels like it's not really my language. Seems to be easier to take apart and make art out of it.
Make a collage.
Make a collage out of it, yeah, because it seems like I can do more with it because it's something that's sort of imposed on me. So I'm kind of looking at it and then I want to braid it into my kind of thinking to make it work for me. That's how English has been for me. And I have a good time doing it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be writing. But I like to see what happens when these perspectives meet and what kind of new language they create. I hope that's poetry.
You are also a visual artist. In fact, the cover of Flood Song, your second book, that came out in 2009 and was the American Book Award winner and the Penn Open Book Award winner, has one of your paintings on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. How big is this painting? It looks like a watercolor.
That's an acrylic piece, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's about 4 by 5 feet. It's a bigger painting. It's probably the largest painting I've done.
Where is it hanging?
A collector has it in Albuquerque, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's called Drought.
Which is the name of one of your poems, actually.
Yeah, in Shapeshift. So when I was writing a lot of these poems, I wrote a poem and then I painted a painting and I would give them the same titles. So a lot of these paintings of mine, they share a title with my poem. Drought is inside Shapeshift. And then also there seems to be this sort of flooding within the cover also, I thought.
Yeah, it looks beautiful. Yeah. It really does. It's amazing. I wondered if it was a link between the first book and the second book.
Yeah, they're all linked. I feel like I'm going to be writing one big poem or one large book. All of my work is connected. My paintings are connected to the poems, and I do photographs, and they're connected to the poems, and eventually I'll have a film that is connected to. The real root of all of my work is poetry. Or maybe they're all images.
Or maybe they're both.
Yeah, maybe they're both, yeah. But they're all connected. So the drought is on the cover, but afterwards you have the flood.
You know, it was interesting that your work is a continuum because there are no titles in Flood Song.
Uh-huh.
One piece floods into the other, and there were some blank pages there that I was like, okay, this must mean here's an ending or here's a beginning. But there is that sense of a continuum. So it's interesting to hear you say that. So I wasn't so far off base.
No,
then.
You weren't. No.
That makes me feel better.
The Flood Song is a book-length poem, but I don't feel like it is contained within the book. You can enter the book at any point. I didn't want to have a beginning or ending or titles. It all works as a continuum. And a lot of times when I read the book in public, I skip around. It probably confuses a lot of people, but I really don't feel like it's a poem that needs a beginning or an end. It's a flood. It occurs as it occurs in nature. No warning there.
There you go, breaking up that linear thing again, you know?
Yep. That's what I'm doing.
I do want to talk about how you begin this with just the repeat of a word. And it looks like the word to, T-O, with an accent.
Yeah, this is actually the word for water. It's a poem that came to me while I was visiting a university in Illinois, in southern Illinois. One of the professors took me out to Cahokia, which is an ancient mound builder site. And I remember walking under these trees, and every time we would walk under a tree, the wind would shake the tree, and all of a sudden a leaf would drop to the floor. A couple of times this happened. I'm like, this is really interesting. Why is there one solitary leaf that falls to the floor? And so the shape of the poem began there, but also just the idea that water is dripping down the middle of the page. And the word is toi. So the poem is basically toi, toi. Toi, 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 toi,
toi. That opens up Sherwin Bitsui's Flood Song. And then we are flooded with lots of different images in between the human world, the natural world, the modern world, the ancient world, all going on at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are dealing so much in our conversation today with language and the differences in language and what that does to link us and also separate us.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have you read one of the short poems in the book Flood Song. This one's on page 24. It begins with hummingbirds. What do hummingbirds mean in Navajo?
I don't really know personally. I'm sure they have some sort of place, but I just use them because I was living in Tucson at the time and we had a lot of hummingbirds.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Frightening little creatures.
They're
beautiful,
actually,
too.
They're gorgeous, yeah, but they're so territorial. They're you know, the way they chase each other around is something.
Hummingbirds scratch out the last tooth from the doorknob held up as an offering to the sun. Horses gallop toward the hive in which our fingers claw the slit. Computer light trickles in from under moist fingernails. A twig yanked from the nervous eye of a dying bull grows from red earth, becomes the ore we use to sop aside our thirst. They want you to speak open a window slick with coyote's sweat. Trail poems onto ladders of forest smoke and hoist into bed with the bristles of the broom you write freedom with. A blanket of questions billowing like windswept feathers out of our closed eyes. Until there is no tongue to smooth away the hairline fracture between us and them.
There's a lot going on there. But again, you've got this whole modern day computer and some of the things that keep recurring throughout your poetry. Horses, we see the coyote occasionally. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing with that juxtaposition.
I think there's a lot of commentary on a contemporary situation within the work. Certainly within this part of the book, there is a breakthrough occurring, but at the same time, it's not natural light that is trickling in, it's computer light. So if one were to look at the actions that are happening in this piece, then you kind of realize that we're in a changed world, we're in a new world. I was always interested in the temperature of things and what do they mean, what created that line. So I look at this work as somewhat of a residue of an experience that happened right before it. Why then is the hummingbird scratching out the last tooth from the doorknob held up as an offering to the sun? So that could be a question of the doorknob being something that is invested upon or something that is ubiquitous to American culture, but suddenly given as an offering, but also has a teeth embedded in it that the hummingbird is trying to loosen. I mean, really, these are painterly images.
They are, aren't they? Yes. Yeah, there's so much of that visual.
Yeah.
And I think that's your artist eye also working with the tongue.
Mm-hmm. Coyote appears in this work also, but, you know, they want you to speak open a window. And definitely there's a lot of symbolism occurring in the work. What is a window? But the window is slick with coyote sweat. So coyote, again, trickster, has somehow been there. His presence is there, but he's not there. So within the work, there are all these areas that one has to enter and very kaleidoscopically, or there's a type of labyrinth that is inside the work as well. So they are speaking to something outside of the poem, but also just as images, just for the sensation of an image, they also, I think, are satisfying, hopefully, for the audience or the reader. But again, there is no tongue to smooth away the hairline fracture between us and them is really a line that speaks to a lot of different things, even the border politics in the Southwest, you know, this notion of us versus them and who are them. And I certainly noticed that just even from crossing the reservation border into the rest of America and also the border life that I live within. I definitely have to cross into a lot of places all the time simply because of my connection to this country's history. The political history. I mean, what is that tongue that will smooth it away? What is that tongue that will help us communicate with one another? And I'm hoping it's poetry or maybe it's an image, maybe it's a painting. When we come to art, we definitely experience our humanity and we're definitely faced with it. It's definitely a mirror that is held up at us. And I think that's what I really am aiming for.
The reservation that you're from is in northern Arizona, right?
Yeah, I was born and raised on the Navajo Reservation.
Can we talk a little bit about your family? What do they think of your poetry?
They've been to my readings. They support me. And my dad's very proud of me. My dad's a carpenter for over almost 40 years now. And my mom has read my work. She kind of pulls it apart every now and then. But we don't have huge conversations about my poetry around the dinner table. There's other pressing issues at hand. You know, one of my aunts is still waiting for me to get a real job, you know, like any other poet in the world probably has an aunt out there or a grandmother who's like, get a real job, you know. But I think the rest of the family, everybody in my family has been very supportive.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind.
Do you think they think that you're mapping a shrinking map? That's a line. I'm stealing a line from one of your poems.
I think they know intimately where my work comes from, and it does come from my experience, and maybe it is something that they have felt, and definitely I've lived that experience and I return to that experience. So as an artist, I hopefully express something that is being felt, and maybe words are not to be trusted always for the literal meaning, but that perhaps the feeling of a line or the feeling of the book somehow resonates with what is underneath everything at the moment. I really hope to be a poet of my time. When I speak to my family, and as I travel and as I go places, and I go home, there's so much beauty and so much joy, and also so much disparity as well on all the reservations. Not to feed into stereotypes, but to show that the beautiful and the terrible are right next to each other consistently. And I think that we certainly live in that space constantly.
Yeah. Well, let me hear you read 46 from Flood Song.
Coyote howls into windows painted on the floor with crushed turquoise. Captured cranes secrete radon in the epoxied tool shed. Leopard spots ripe for drilling ooze white gas when hung on a copper wire. I pull electricity from their softened bellies with loom yarn. I map a shrinking map.
Sherwin Bitsui, in 2011, reading from Flood Song, winner of both the 2010 American Book Award and the Penn Open Book Award. Copper Canyon Press published that, and later his 2018 book, Dissolve. We also heard from his first collection, Shapeshift, from the University of Arizona Press, recorded while Sherwin Bitsui was in Kansas City for Park University's Ethnic Voices Poetry Series. For links to this audio and his books, search for Sherwin Bitsui, spelled BITSUI, on the website newletters.org. New Letters on the Air has been broadcasting continuously since 1977, and though we enjoy bringing you these classic recordings, we'd like to produce new interviews and programs. To join the team to support this radio show, call and leave a message at 888-548-2477 or email radio@newletters.org. That number again is 888-548-2477. Originally produced with Andrew Hansbrough, Stephanie Hughes, and Annie Walsh, thanks for the show also go to Virginia Brackett, Olivia Gallo, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.